Let's go ahead and start. Good morning. This is obviously the September 11th work session on the Portland building. Excellent. Thank you, Tom.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioner Fritz. We are excited to be here today. For the record, my name is Tom Reinhart. I'm proud to be the Chief Administrative Officer for the great city of Portland. I'm very privileged to be up here with my colleague, Kristen Wells, the project lead. We also have project team members behind us as well. And on behalf of the literally hundreds of women and men working on this project, we are excited to be updating you on the progress and the excellent work done to date. This is purely an update. We are not asking for direction. We're not asking you to resolve any of the thorny questions that we have resolved to date, and surely a couple are still ahead of us. And if you remember two things from this presentation today, we hope you remember the following. We are ahead of time, and we are on budget. So I will repeat that a couple times, but knowing all the various...
I want to make sure Gordon wrote that.
We are ahead of time, and we are on budget, and we expect you to hold us accountable to both. So if I'm just going to take a brief moment to talk about the overview of what we are going to do in our time together. We're going to spend the first third of the presentation just getting regrounded in the history of the building, how we got here, why we are doing this massive effort. Then we're going to update you on everything that's happened since reconstruction began up to today and what we forecast for the end. And then I'm going to spend some time as your CAO talking through what I perceive as the important lessons and the broad impacts of the project, considering nearly a third of our employees citywide full-time will be in this building by 2025. And it's our downtown center in terms of service and the location of our government center. So I'm going to talk about how it's impacting our entire operation. Now I'm going to turn it over to Kristen to both introduce herself and walk through the building history.
Hi, I'm Kristen Wells, project lead for the Portland Building Reconstruction Project. Good morning. So I'm going to walk through some of the history of how did we get to where we're at today, just as a memory. Do you want to come to the side? So through the years since the Portland Building's inception, it had a series of problems, mostly around water issues, but also some structural issues. And there were multiple attempts to fix the construction issues, and all of them eventually resulted in failed attempts. And so in 2015, council directed us to reconstruct the Portland Building. We looked at a series of options prior to that decision, whether or not we should tear the building down and rebuild it, whether we should move elsewhere and sell the building. There were financial models, and there was a lot of look at kind of what's the quality and the best decision for the city. And the ultimate decision was reconstructing it in place would be the best both financial and quality choice for the city. When we decided to rebuild it, we looked at all of the issues that we would have to undertake. And we proposed to construct it using an alternative method, progressive design build. The progressive design build method is an iterative process. We have been co-located with Howard S. Wright and DLR Group, and our DACPM owner's representative since we began with them in 2016. And that approach has allowed a lot more collaboration and creative thinking, and I believe that has led to much of the success of the project to date, including the being ahead of schedule and on budget.
This is where I get a quick cameo in this section. I just want to call out the fact that the governance model on this, which I'll talk about at the end as well, has been a key element of its success. We have an excellent oversight committee that has been invaluable to me as the CAO and to the rest of the team in providing all sorts of advice, troubleshooting, assessment, grading us as we go along. I know that we have one oversight committee member here at least today. We have Carl Farrington. Thanks for being here, Carl. Oh, I see Tom Walsh as well. Thanks, Tom, for being here. Sorry if I'm missing anybody else. But Bob Ball, Carl Farrington, Cindy Nickel, Don Shanklin, and Tom Walsh have been an excellent layer of accountability and support. And I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end.
So work completed to date. As I mentioned before, council approved us. We put a stake in the ground at $195 million and completion by the end of 2020. At that point, we didn't yet know if employees were going to move out of the building or if we were going to try to reconstruct with employees in the building. Budgetarily, we are on track to meet the $195 million. The pie chart up there shows the separation between construction dollars, the other soft costs borne by the owner, and then the owner's representative contract.
Welcome.
It's a little hard to read on the slide in this light, but it shows the percent complete to date is a slightly darker shade than the lighter shade. So we are roughly 30 to 40% spent to date, and we are tracking on target with about 90% of the buyout for construction complete. One of the...
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
What does that mean, 90% of the buyout for construction?
So with Progressive Design Build, we brought on Howard S. Wright and DLR Group on a contract that would cover all of construction and all of design. But Howard S. Wright needs to buy out all the subcontractors. Howard S. Wright is about 90% bought out of all of their subcontractors, which means we haven't... we have not experienced any major surprises to date. So that's the buyout.
Thank you.
Yeah. One of the ways that we've controlled costs on the project is mitigating major risks. And so some of those major risks was finalizing the leases early on. We knew that lease prices were going up, and that was a big risk regarding whether or not there was going to be availability in the marketplace for our roughly nearly 1,400 employees that we had at the time. We completed all of the moves on budget. We actually came in under budget on the total lease costs, which was fantastic and allowed a little breathing room in the budget. Landmarks approval, this is a historic building, and it is not a traditional reconstruction of a landmark building. And so we did a lot of work with our Historic Landmarks Commission to present why reconstructing this in a different model, given that it is postmodern architecture, was the right way to go. And Landmarks agreed with us and approved the project. The permitting completion, there's always risks around permitting, and we have completed all the major permitting. The deferred submittals are going through right now. Some of them are approved. A couple of them are still to go, but we don't anticipate any surprises there. Demolition is always a risk during construction. Demolition has gone very smoothly. There were no major discoveries during demolition, and that is an area that often much of your contingency ends up going to. So we've been able to reserve that contingency. Also, the only earthwork that we had related to the project, which is, again, an area of high risk for most construction projects, was the structural mat slab under the building that is helping with our increase in seismic resiliency. And we did not find any major discoveries during that earthwork. So we are moving forward with most of the major risks already mitigated. Schedule-wise, we recently announced that we are a year ahead of schedule from when council directed us to be complete. The direction was end of 2020. We will start the move-backs at the end of 2019 now. There were two primary reasons for that early completion date. The first was the decision to move employees out of the building. That decision was made early in the design work with Howard S. Wright and DLR, looking at the risk of keeping employees in the building versus moving them out. and going ahead and bearing the lease costs. That decision moved us up to the moves were originally going to start around January of 2020 in our GMP with a two-phase move back in January and April. Due to construction strategies, we were able to change the approach. Once we started doing the interior shear wall, Howard S. Wright was able to get some improved methodologies that allowed us to move that forward quicker in a more streamlined way, and that has shifted the schedule up a few additional months, and so now we expect substantial completion in November of 2019. The slide up there right now, I won't go through it in detail, but this is our overall construction schedule. We're including it primarily for those looking at this later, so that you can have a sense of when the primary work will be starting. Demolition, as I mentioned, is mostly complete. The seismic upgrades, the mat slab insulation, and the shear wall are well underway. We're a third, almost half of the way up through the building, a third of the way through the building with the shear wall. The mechanical, electrical, plumbing coordination is nearly complete. And the unitized curtain wall, which is visually what many people are waiting to see with the crane flying panels in, that should begin this fall. So that is a big milestone that we'll be looking forward to seeing. Scope. So council directed us with a very basic scope. Basic in the sense that it was our minimum scope that we had to achieve. And it was all of the things that we needed to do to remedy the building and bring it up to a base standard of offices and workplace for the city today, including accessibility upgrades, including restoring the historic lobby, and fixing all of the structural and envelope issues that we've had, and upgrading the seismic to today's standards. So that was the direction we had. The cap was 195 in 2020, and we started off the building, the design work, looking at that scope and making sure that we could meet every one of those scope items. We have achieved every one of those scope items through the design and the construction, but we were also able to go through a visioning process. So part of progressive design build is best value design. And so early on, at the very beginning, we met with all of our bureaus that will be in this building. We had multiple meetings with employees, and what you see on the screen is a word cloud that came out of a survey of employees of what would you like to see in the building. If we're going to spend $195 million reconstructing this, it sure would be great to put it back in a better way, in a way that meets the needs of our employees now and well into the future. So those were items that were important to our employees. Bright, comfortable, light, healthy, clean, were all words that resonated. Out of the visioning process, we came up with three principles, three areas of focus. The first being public first. We wanted to create a building for our public. This is, you know, everything that we do is serving our public. All of the money used to reconstruct the building are public tax dollars. So it was very important to put public first, and that has driven a lot of changes in how we do business. In addition, the employee experience, there has been a lot of negative feedback on the previous employee experience in that building and how it did not support our employees. So this has been a big focus, to focus on how do we improve our employee experience. And then the third big piece was collaboration. Rather than having a building where our bureaus were locked off from each other and separated, we really looked at how do we encourage collaboration between our employees, both within the bureaus as well as across the bureaus. So with that, the public first, we focus on our public-facing services. The first and second floor are all about our public employees, or our public that we serve. We have one centralized customer service area, and then we have a number of meeting spaces, which we'll get to in a moment. the employee workspace and then the shared conferencing was how we achieve collaboration. In addition, we've got a third place in collaboration zones. This was a new concept that we have not had much within the city, is this idea of the third place. So our employees will not only have their individual workspace and their meeting spaces, but they will also have areas to go to work and to collaborate and to take their breaks. The 15th floor is an amenity space, support space for all of our bureau employees. It includes dining facilities as well as workspaces for individual and group work. Daylighting and lighting have been a huge focus of the reconstruction project. We have been able to expand the amount of daylight. Erica, I'm going to look to you. I think 20% increased daylighting to 20%, and also converted all of the what was previously black glass to daylight clear glass. So that will make a huge impact on our employees. And then we're going through a branding process with our bureaus and with defining how we want to provide wayfinding and share who we are. So one of the concepts that supports employees is this idea of an active-based workspace. In the past, we've had cubicles and we've had private offices, and everything you were to do for your daily work pretty much happened either in your cubicle or your office or in a meeting room. With this third space concept and active workspace, the individual spaces is somewhat exploded throughout the building. So there are places, if you need to lay out drawings or lay out a number of sheets of paper, you don't need to do that within your cubicle space. There are layout spaces you can go to and have the right amount of room. There are a number of focus rooms. If you need to have a private conversation, whether that's work-related or individually related, there are phone rooms or focus rooms that you can go in, have a private conversation with one other person or on the phone, and get your work done without distraction. And these have a higher acoustic value as well. Every employee will be assigned an individual locked storage space, locker, on their bureau assigned floor. This allows for the storage of things outside of your individual workspace so as not to clutter it, but also to allow the future of hoteling or flexible workspaces as bureaus choose to do that. And then files. Many of our bureaus had files scattered around floors, and it was hard to find where they are, so now we are collecting shared file areas in distinct locations on the floors.
Could you explain the concept?
Certainly. So hoteling is when you're not assigned an individual desk, but you come in and you find a desk that works for you for that day. And it might be a different place on different days depending on the work that you're going to do that day. So if I need to do heads down work, I might choose to check out an office for the day. If I need to do a lot of collaboration work, I might choose a pod or an area of work where I can sit with my team and collaborate over tables. So it's a more flexible work environment. At this point, none of the bureaus are choosing that option, but that is an option in the future. It also allows for flexibility with flex work schedules. If you have employees that work only in the office only a couple days a week, that they can flex between workspaces on those different days.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Questions about lockers. Are they like high school lockers where you put your coat?
Similar, yes. A little bit nicer. But yes, they're half-height lockers, so they're not, they won't fit a long jacket, but a standard jacket they would fit.
So where would you put your raincoat when it's something like
that? Either in your locker and it would be a little bit short, or in your cubicle still, or in your workspace.
Well, basically drapes over the back of your chair because you don't have a workspace?
Similar to what our employees did before, yes. So the workspaces aren't dramatically different from our previous workspaces, but they're just a bit more open than they were before. So the a little more on the active-based workspace. It also takes the me and the we and provides more spaces for that. So previously, your me space with just your individual cubicle or office. Now we have shared support spaces and personal storage that support those functions. And then the we space used to be just conference rooms. Now there's huddle rooms, which are a collection of small 4 to 6 person meeting areas, open collaboration areas, which are out in the open areas where you can meet with other employees, and then the third places, as we mentioned. So one of the things I mentioned in terms of our public first concept was the customer service desk and zone. So we now have the southwest corner of the building. We'll be focused on customer service. We are now opened up. The whole front of the building will be wrapped with glazing that is visible from the street. So people can see in, people can see out. We are showing government at work, and we are welcoming our public members in. In addition, all of the work that you need to accomplish as a public member coming into the building, we are going to greet you rather than you trying to find us somewhere in the building. So all of our customer service folks will be in this one zone. There are small meeting rooms to support if you need to have a longer conversation with an employee, and there are tables around in this zone to support that those functions. In addition, there are two large meeting and event spaces on the ground floor. One is shown on the lower left there. That is our event space. It opens directly up to the loggia, which is that front deep under overhanging space. So in the evening times or off hours, we can invite public events in that space without opening up the entire building, which provides a safer environment. It's a self-sufficient area with restrooms and a service kitchen in that space. In addition, on the right is our large meeting room. This replaces what used to be our auditorium function in a more flexible way. We can fit about 250 people in that room comfortably in a lecture-style configuration, but it can also be arranged in multiple configurations. And that is being designed to be council's backup chambers when you do need to move across the street as you used to before. Sustainability was another big goal on the project, continues to be. We are on track to meet LEED Gold, and we have passed the first level of the design review for that LEED Gold certification. We are also on this project pursuing WELL certification. WELL certification is a newer certification. It's connected to LEED but focuses on the occupants of the building. And the seven areas of focus are on the slide there: air, water, nourishment, light, fitness, comfort, and mind. And it is a testing-based certification. So it is not just about what you put in the building, but actually testing the air and the water quality after the fact. And they will come back every 3 years if we decide to recertify to ensure that we are continuing to meet all of the requirements and the goals to provide the best employee experience.
Okay. Back to you. My section, and I'm pretty good at reading body language, but not when council's behind me. So if anyone has a question before I proceed, happy to take it. Yes, please.
My understanding of third place is something that's distinctly separate from home and work. So are you using that term to describe?
Just a second. If we're talking from here, the caption is come here.
I was just going to suggest we repeat.
Why don't we use this last mic here to ask a question?
I don't want to.
Here, it's wireless.
The question's third place.
Thank you,
Mayor.
Okay. A little traumatized by the microphone I was singing into last night. So my understanding of third place is a space that is very distinct from home or work, so I want to make sure that I understand the way you're using the term in this context. Is it essentially chill spaces within an office building?
It is both. It is, so how we've described third place for this project, it is essentially the Starbucks or the Barnes & Noble spaces. So it is not your work and it is not your primary workspace, but it is another space that you can go to either to work or to collaborate or to, yes, take a moment of breathing space, take a break, if you will, that is not in a lunchroom cafeteria that feels like a lunchroom cafeteria.
Thank you for being nimble, counsel, with the microphone. Appreciate it. Our update on equity. I'm going to walk you through various slides. I want counsel to know that the city set very aggressive goals on both workforce development and contracting equity. And in terms of our overall goals, we are meeting or exceeding all of the overall goals. When we disaggregate the goals, which is now best practice that we are following as a city, we do show slight projected shortfalls in two areas that I want to talk to you about. So this first slide in workforce diversity, on the left you see the overall apprenticeship rate goal. So people getting into the skilled trades, public sector projects are a unique and important opportunity for people to get more hours as they are learning a skilled trade. Our overall goal is 20%. We are tracking to hit 26% on our apprenticeship rate. On the right, you see the numbers for female and minority apprentices, a 9% goal and a 22% goal, respectively, and we are tracking at 23 and 38. Next slide. When you look at the journey-level workers in workforce development goals, you can see that our goals for minority journey workers and female journey workers, we are exceeding them at 27 and 8. Next slide, please. For professional, technical, and expert services, PTE as we call them in the industry, we have an overall goal that you see on the far right of 20% that the city set. Our partners in the design, build, reconstruct effort set a more aggressive goal at 22%, which we appreciated in the RFP process. They came forward with even more strong goals than we had. And you can see where we are tracking it below for emerging small businesses, women business enterprises, and minority business enterprises. I will have you note that on the right there in the disaggregated goals, we are forecasting a slight shortage in minority business enterprises. Next slide, please. Okay, the context in this, I think, is very important in terms of the historic a construction boom, both private and public market, that we are seeing. We are one of several large-scale construction projects, and I wanted council to be assured that we are hearing both the previous council's directive and this council's directive to continue to shoot high in terms of our work on PTE and MBE, WBE, ESB, and you'll see where we land in comparison here to the headquarters hotel, the county courthouse, Multnomah County's health headquarters, and Portland Public Schools bond projects, that our goals are slightly higher, and we will show you more slides in terms of the context as we move ahead here. Next slide, please. Subcontracting goals on construction. As Kristen said, we have 90% completion on the buyout of the work. You'll see on the far right in that column that the city's goal and the reconstruction team's goals have been we are forecasting to exceed those for subcontracting goals. As you will note below, ESB and WBE, collectively we are outperforming those goals, and we are forecasting a 1% shortage on MBE. We did put a little side note in here that one of the learnings that we are gleaning from the project that I will be making policy recommendations on at the end is, as the city continues to take a stronger stance in terms of equity, contracting, and workforce development, we are noticing some policies and programs that inadvertently can work at cross purposes. We had a $2.3 million award to an MBE contractor under the Prime Contractor Development Program, which is one of the city's jewels in this work. It's beloved both internally and in the community, and we were not aware on the project side that this would not count towards our MBE goal. We should be incentivized to use the Prime Contracting Development Program. It's a great program, and we're going to work out for future projects like filtration and other large-scale construction projects how to move forward so that this doesn't happen in the future. Next slide. Again, the context we believe is very important. You'll see that we are forecasting to do much better than our peers in terms of how we actually deliver on our goals in the equity, inclusion, and diversity plan that was attached to this project. That being said, we are also working with all the partners on the fact that we continue to face a shortage of skilled workers, and we know that collectively we can do better at engaging women business enterprises and minority business enterprises, and we need to do a better job coordinating these projects going forward. Again, I want to pause there, knowing that I have not been able to read any facial expressions or head nods or any indications of concern.
Okay.
So could I call council back up for the broader impacts, please, considering the slides won't be that revealing from my content. They're excellent slides that Janet put together, but the bullet points aren't that impactful. I want to talk you through a little bit of this. So as I said at the outset of the presentation, this is a highly impactful project due to the scale and the fact that this is our government center building and that we historically have performed a lot of customer service functions out of this building. And as your chief administrative officer, along with being your project sponsor on this, I have been very intent on spending time with people on capitalizing on the project in several ways. So first, council did an excellent job setting up what I think has been the perfect governance model for this. You gave clear direction on what you wanted to happen. You gave us an end date. You gave us a cap on the budget that we have to adhere to. And you gave the chief administrative officer, my predecessor, Fred Miller, and myself, authority as the project sponsor to make dozens and dozens of difficult decisions. This has worked very well to date. We have had excellent oversight, as I've mentioned, by your appointees to the oversight committee, but we have largely avoided what happens to a lot of public sector projects in that there are too many people making decisions, we take too long to make them, or we make decisions that in many ways aren't the best for the future long-term operations of the city. So I have been using the learning from this already for the Portland Online and Permitting Project governance, from various governance models that we set up on difficult, thorny projects for the city. So I wanted you to know that. You'll hear more about that from me. Lastly, on this slide, I cannot overstate the importance of bureau collaboration and ownership of this process. All of your bureaus have very ambitious, complicated work plans above and beyond what we've asked them to do for this project. I want to publicly thank all the directors, managers, and employees that we've asked to do a lot on this project. We've asked them to change the way they think about work. We've moved them into temporary spaces. We've asked them to participate in various work groups. I visited at least one other city in the last year in which they were very surprised that we even asked our employees the questions we're asking them. But I think it behooves us that there's broad ownership of the changes we are trying to make and that we are asking people, even if we don't agree with all the input and make a different decision, people are bought into this and directors are working hard to make it happen. Next slide. Kristen mentioned customer service. As a Portlander now for almost 17 years, I'm sure I'm not alone in this room of hearing different ways that people have had frustration interacting with the city. We are using this project as a major opportunity to streamline the way this works. The mantra is no Portland resident should have to know a thing about our form of government when they come in to ask a question or seek out a service in the Portland building. That's on us. So we have worked very hard with the bureaus that do a lot of the forward-facing interactions in the future first floor of the Portland building to make sure that we have enough cross-training and enough of the ability to answer basic questions and help people get bills paid and go to the places they need to go seamlessly. You will have another work session in November that lays out how the 311 program and the website refresh are also integrated into this project because we think they're all one part of making Portlanders' accessibility to government easier and easier for our employees as well. Space optimization. You and your colleagues approved in January of 2017 a parallel project connected to this effort, which is to completely modernize and update the way we purchase and manage our furniture. The then chief financial officer and myself, so Ken Rust and myself, came in front of you with a proposal for $18.8 million that will be added to the financing of this project, that will enable us to buy systems furniture and bring in eventually 1,776 employees into the building instead of 1,340. So to optimize our space and our asset, it is also allowing us to use more of the space than we initially planned. This is very had a very deep impact on the way that we think about how we work. And we are also trying to spread this conversation to the 1900 building and other city-owned facilities, not only to optimize taxpayer dollars, but also to collaborate differently. And as you'll see on the next slide, how we manage these assets differently. A very challenging conversation for all of our bureaus has been the fact that we are also using this opportunity to change the way we manage the building. Historically, bureaus have had broad latitude to add furniture, move things around, add walls, paint, do a lot of things that had no overlap or very little communication with the actual facilities management budget and operation of the building. That is no more, and we are working on a change management process with the bureaus and new operating agreements with facilities around how we will make sure that we are flexible in terms of how we use the space, that changes aren't approved and made that will inhibit our ability to use the space in the future. Bureaus will change and grow, and they will shift. We will need less and more space for some bureaus. We want to make sure every floor is flexible enough that we can add people and grow and change as we need to. Kristen mentioned the hoteling space. We have clear trends on the way work is changing. We've already seen them in the temporary spaces. We have at least one bureau that has a very aggressive approach to remote work in the temp spaces, and they are going to continue that in the new building. So we want to make sure we don't build walls, figurative or literal, that we cannot change in the future as work changes. More to come on that. Carmen Merlo, the deputy CEO, is working very hard on that right now. Citywide technology, question mark. So you as a governing body will see a proposal for us in the fall bump that is really from my role as CAO and not project sponsor. As Kristen talked about in terms of the scope, the reconstruction project funded what's called pipe and box, the infrastructure into the walls for technology. I began a discussion about a year ago with Bureau leadership about the fact that my responsibility as a project sponsor is to be on time and on budget, but my responsibility as a CIO is to look out in terms of what the bureaus are going to need in the future. It became very clear to me that the Bureau expectations on audiovisual equipment, integrated printer management, meaning you can go to any printer in any floor of the building, get your print job confidentially printed, the conference room set up so that we don't have the continued frustrations of bringing in a laptop to a room that doesn't fit in a conference room on one floor, but it fits on another floor. We have a proposal to you to be for a first stage of an entire downtown citywide build-out on updated technology. We have strong support from bureaus, but that is your call as a separate project related to this, but not in this budget. If you like this package, we have constructed it so that it could also move to City Hall a year or two later and then to the 1900 building so that the entire city downtown infrastructure will be updated so that we can continue to have the technology tools that our employees need. I think I should stop there. I want to reinforce with you that I know you've put a lot of faith into us on this project. I briefed all of you individually as we've gone along, but I want to thank you again for showing a lot of faith in us that we can do this well. And before we close, I want to thank the team behind me, Howard S. Wright, DLR Group, Day, CPM, our owner's rep, and all the city employees that have put an incredible amount of time and effort into this. We have pushed them hard. We have asked them to do a lot. We have asked the private sector partners to also do a lot and change some of the work they do. So thank you. And we will take any questions and we'll call anybody up that can answer a question that Kristen and I cannot.
Very impressive presentation, very impressive work. Thank you very much. I was struck in the earlier presentation about being a year ahead of schedule, which would tend to make one think that one would be way under budget, but you said we're on budget. So if we're saving a year's worth of paying construction workers because it's getting done faster, what is costing more than we're expecting it to cost?
That's a great question. So the budget was fixed. The time was fixed as a maximum. As I mentioned, one of the early decisions was whether or not we would keep people in the building or move people out of the building. That is a cost-time-benefit decision. So if we had kept people in the building, it would have complicated a lot of the construction. It would have limited what we could have done, but it would have saved nearly $15 million of lease costs. So that is part of that balancing of the budget and balancing of the time and what is the best long-term decision for the city. And it was decided that the best long-term decision for the city was to really be able to completely reconstruct the building, and we could not do that unless we had employees out of the building.
Thank you. And then
Commissioner Fritz, can I add to that before you go to the next question?
Okay,
one more piece on that is and Kristen has been very faithful to the fact that we have been jealously guarding contingencies, knowing we just don't know. We, on the slide that was earlier in the presentation about the risks mitigated, we have been pleasantly surprised that there have been no major surprises. But we have a healthy contingency. We are still guarding that. So I think it is fair to say that people that review our financial statements, like Carl, would say that we are tracking under budget, but we don't want to make that commitment yet until we know exactly what the costs are in the end game here.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. And then on a different topic, on accessibility, do you have a committee that's advising you on accessibility standards and best practices?
We do not have a committee specific to accessibility best practices. We work closely with our design team, who are all trained in accessibility standards. I actually have a personal history in that as well. And we have met with HR and their accessibility and employee, or their employee focusing on accessibility as well, to make sure that we're meeting the intent of the city for our employees. So we've been doing it in a different way other than committees, but we have.
Yeah, I guess I'm concerned. I know that the national standards aren't necessarily getting us where we need to be. I'm thinking of some of the new buildings in South Waterfront that you can't get, you know, some of the hospital buildings had problems getting wheelchairs into the bathrooms, et cetera.
Absolutely.
And then it's also in the development services building, which we haven't yet paid off. There were many things on the transition plan that we had to take care of back when I was in charge of it, because of just handles being the wrong height and those kinds of things. So I just want to make sure that that's high on somebody's priority list, to make sure that when we have this building opening, there's not any kind of, oh, I can't reach the button.
Absolutely. National standards are built to a certain level that meets the legal requirements of accessibility, but they are not designed for universal design, and we are striving for what's called universal design, which is a broader reach, and it takes a wider range of disabilities into consideration, including disabilities that come with aging or a number of other impacts. So it is a broader look that we are doing, and it is not just meeting the minimum code requirements.
I would think particularly for the second floor and first floor event spaces, if we could look at putting the cochlear loops in as part of the construction. I know we've looked at trying to do it in City Hall, and retroactively it's fairly expensive, but to do it as part of the construction, things like that would,
absolutely,
I think, be something to be thinking about.
Yeah.
I forgot what my other question was, so go ahead, Commissioner.
Well, I'll piggyback on that. I would just like to say that I'm pleased to hear that you are pursuing universal design standards, because we know that, sorry, too much singing last night. The ADA doesn't always meet everyone's needs. And I do want to strongly encourage, it's probably a little late in the game at this point, but bureaus to tap the resources we have in the Commission on Disability. They're actually working with the Art Museum on the Rothko Pavilion and have really changed the conversation around that, not just the pavilion, but how they're reconfiguring the museum, which is really exciting. And the other, I don't want to belabor the utilization shortfalls, but can you send me that presentation and maybe we could have a conversation? Because that's just an issue of particular interest to me, and I want to dig into it with you and try to figure out some solutions.
Happy to do that, and I will bring draft recommendations for future projects. I will state too, I meet with the I'm on the executive team of the project, so we have been digging into what we need to do in the closing months and the buyout to also make up the shortfall. We're not taking our foot off the gas, and we're working really hard to make those goals.
Great.
Do you want to add anything to that, Kristen? Okay.
Oh, Commissioner Fritz.
I just remembered my other question.
Great.
Gender-neutral bathrooms. I mean, what are you doing about the whole bathroom issue?
We still have final decisions to make on bathrooms, and we have a little bit of time. What I have directed the project to do is build infrastructure on all the floors for the same number of stalls in two bathrooms on each floor. We will not have urinals in this building. We will have equal number of stalls. And it'll give the city, no matter who's on the governing board and who's the CAO, in the future the ability to put signage up as we see fit in terms of how we want to address the changing nature of bathrooms. We haven't made a decision on what those signs are yet. First and second floor, 3 through 14 and 15. And I'm having conversations with people and getting recommendations from groups that know a lot more than I about this, about what we should do. I will say there is already growing interest in making sure that we have multi-user on each floor, and that's already a decision. We will have multi-user on each floor regardless of what we decide on signage for the other two spaces. So in short, we will have on each employee floor two different banks of rooms of stalls and a single-user multi-user. And as we go forward, I will make sure I update you on decisions on what the signage is on each of those bathrooms.
That sounds promising. I do encourage you to go see Pioneer Courthouse Square, which I consider state-of-the-art. And also, equal number of stalls is not equitable because women have more to do and we take longer. So there needs to be more stalls for the if there are going to be designated gender-specific, there needs to be more.
We have heard this and many other points of feedback, and we're working really hard. I'm sensitive. There's lots of different groups of people that have strong feelings on this issue, and I'm taking time to go listen to them.
You're looking at one of them, Tom.
but I appreciate that.
Well, I'm just really pleased with the renovations that we did at Providence Park, that the line for the women's room is often less than the men's room sometimes, and that is a good thing.
You have anything to add to that? Did I do an okay job on that answer? Okay.
Great.
I'll hear about it.
Great. I have a couple of questions. Number one, have all the bonds been issued for this project?
We have not yet issued the first tranche of bonds for this. We are in conversation.
What's the schedule?
Well, the chief financial officer is actually drafting a memo now to recommend that we move more quickly on issuing debt. We thought that we would get a vigorous head nod from the mayor, and we thought the rest of the council would agree that bearing the interest rate risk too long is not wise.
No, it's not.
So even if we don't issue all the debt, we are going to recommend issuing a first tranche soon.
Good. Could I please, as soon as we know from debt management when they are going to issue the bonds and what the schedule is, I would like to see it, and I want to encourage us to move quickly. So that's thing number one. Thing number two, I want to thank you, and I want to congratulate you, and I want to acknowledge that with a $300 million project that, all things considered, is on schedule and on budget.
195, Mayor.
Very good.
Okay.
195, sorry. You're right. The important thing is, in this particular construction environment, there are very few projects, particularly projects that have been in the works as long as this one, that are on time and on budget, because we all know there's been a lot of inflation around both materials as well as labor. So I want to acknowledge the hard work that you and your team have done to keep costs in alignment. Number two, you didn't talk much about this, but it's not just trying to keep the capital construction costs in line. There's some long-term efficiencies here in the design of this building. Can you talk a little bit about that and what your expectations are?
Absolutely. So one of the basic design strategies that will save money into the future is the standardization of the bureau floors. Floors 4 through 14 have all been designed similarly. They will all be built out with the same number of enclosed spaces, which can be used flexibly over time without having to reconstruct. So what we had before was a lot of what we call tenant improvements or changes to the buildings and the walls. Often that left the mechanical system in a less than great state, because every time that you change a wall, you should be rebalancing the mechanical system, and that led to a lot of the poor air quality that we had in the previous building. So long-term saving costs of standardization is actually seen as a huge benefit. In addition, considering each of our mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems, looking to the future, looking long-term, how are we going to make sure that we have the best systems in place that will last for a long period of time. So we've been looking at those long-term uses, as well as mechanically and electrically, looking at energy savings over time, looking at how we insulate the building for those long-term utility uses.
How many employees moved out, and how many are going to move in?
We don't have an exact number of how many moved out. We had 1,336 when we started the project, and in the roughly 6 months from starting the project to moving out, we estimate we had around 1,400 employees, and we are making space for about 1,750 employees coming back in.
So is this because the workforce is growing, or are we going to be relying less on lease space outside of the building?
The initial idea was we would rely less on lease space outside the building. However, our workforce is growing so quickly that we learned that the building will not keep up the pace that our bureaus are growing.
Okay, very good.
And then Mr. Mayor, can I add something?
Oh, yeah, of course, Tom,
it's important
sure.
to note there that the fact that the workforce is growing, and we, by still getting more employees into this building, we are avoiding outlease costs that we would have had to incur, that we don't have to plan for now. And the financial modeling that we used as the case for your extra investment in a parallel project on space optimization continues to bear $25 million in savings over 20 years, because we will avoid leasing additional space downtown.
During the process, employees are in spaces around the city. A lot of them, as you mentioned, are lease space. I was encouraged to hear that you're going to start moving employees back into the building. It sounds like ahead of schedule. Were those month-to-month leases, or were those prearranged set-term leases?
Those were set-term leases. At the point that we leased them, we knew that the first schedule jump. So one of the leases is set to expire at the end of January of 2020, and we will be moving out on time for that lease. Okay. Another lease, we had an option of a three-month extension that we will not be extending that option. And the other term was a three-year fixed term, and that goes to the July of 2020.
Great. And I don't necessarily need all the details now, but Tom, you and I had the opportunity last week to meet with some of our employees who had some concerns about the configuration of the workstations and whatnot. Do I have your commitment that you're in conversations with them and you're talking to them about their needs?
Absolutely. Every time I walk between this building and my office, I have another conversation, which is very healthy. People are feel free to come up and have these conversations. We are working really hard to address them. We also now have a mock-up of workstations and some of the other third space furniture and configurations on the 15th floor of the Congress Center. Kristen's team is going to be bringing people in to see what these configurations are like and what their options are. We are hopeful that that will help, because human beings, we're not very good collectively with uncertainty. The more that we can tangibly see these new workstations and see what these spaces will be like, whether it's a living room space or a shared space or a shared conference table where I need to lay out my plans, my paper plans, we want people to experience that as they're making decisions bureau by bureau about additions and slight changes in their modifications. And of course, you have my commitment that we'll continue to meet with people, and I do an information session roving around the city every month. It's usually very frank and a lot of fun. Questions ranging from the locker rooms to individual workspaces to the food. We benefit from having a workforce that feels like we have an open enough environment to come ask questions. So we will continue to do that.
Very good. And I'll just throw in a non sequitur. As you know, there were a number of people who were approaching us on a regular basis asking us why couldn't we move the Portlandia statue off the building and put it somewhere more visible. And I just want to state what you already know, which is you did a very thorough investigation of that possibility. And the reality is the statue cannot be moved for a variety of reasons, including the fact that it's just a very thin and brittle structure. And the concern was that if there was an attempt to move it, it would actually potentially destroy it. So I just want you to know that what I'm telling people when they ask me about that is that we're going to be doing a lot of development, master plan development, all around the city. And that includes the Broadway corridor, potentially the Zidell site, the Innovation Quadrant down by OMSI, and there are other projects around the city. There is no reason, and I'm sure the artist would be thrilled, if we commissioned him to do a replica or another version elsewhere in the city. So I just want people to be aware we're not locked into an either or, and I do want the public to know that you know, moving the statue was looked at and it just turned out not to be a feasible solution.
Some of us actually love it where it is and would have fought tooth and nail to, if it was to be moved. So just
may I also add to your list of what to tell people that we will have a new viewing platform on the first floor roof coming out of the second floor that the public may gain access to see her closer up.
Great. And last but not least, I wanted to thank Tom and some other people who are here who volunteered a tremendous amount of their time and their energy to help the Portland City Council manage this very, very large project. And without their leadership and their guidance, and poor Tom had to spend a considerable amount of time with me convincing me that this was the right strategy, and he prevailed. And I'm thankful for that, and I want to thank you, Tom, and your team. You've been bird-dogging this project hard. And the public does expect accountability, and they do expect us to spend the resources wisely. And I feel like at every single stage, you and your team have excelled. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Anything else? Very good. Tom, anything else?
That's it. Thanks for your time, Council.
Thank you. We're adjourned.